And so for this Dhamma talk, I want to introduce a couple of themes or expand on a couple of themes from the talk and try to wrap things up a little bit, sort of try to pull together some of the themes that we've touched upon. And I mentioned this morning that I wanted to talk about the topic of samatha and vipassana. Okay, so that's going to be our framework for today. And who can tell me what these things are? Samatha and vipassana. Tranquility and insight. Thank you. Excellent. Very good. So these are two Pali words, samatha and vipassana. Sometimes you'll hear the Sanskrit form, shamatha and vipassana, or vidarshana, same meaning. And so these are essentially the two main kind of aspects or frameworks for meditation in early Buddhism. Okay, so each person here has, and forgive me if I'm being presumptuous, but each person here has a mind. Is that correct? Yes? No mindless automatons here? No? I mean, look, we're getting into a space where you're going to have to be... I mean, if we're on Zoom, somebody might have an AI avatar and they're not actually there. Who knows? Anyway, whatever. So we all have minds. Excellent. Right. How does your mind work exactly? It's kind of hard to say, really, isn't it? Yeah. Kind of does, and then sometimes it doesn't. Okay. Sorry? Conditioned from upbringing? Yeah, that's one of the things, right? Okay. But we have minds, but we don't know how they work, which is why our minds tend to get us into trouble. This is what the Buddha called ignorance, avidya. Yeah. We don't know what the hell is going on. And we keep on doing things that we think are going to be good, and it turns out they're not. They're terrible. And we end up suffering and causing suffering for others as well. And this is ignorant, yeah? Independent origination, which I should make resolve right now not to talk too much about dependent origination, but independent origination, avidya paccaya sankhara. Ignorance conditions choices or activities, right? The things that we do out of ignorance. We don't know who we are. We don't know what we're feeling. We don't know why we're doing the things that we're doing. I mean, we know those things to some degree. It's not, ignorance isn't like total. The Buddha's not saying that we never know anything about anything. But there is a fundamental level at which we are really just not comprehending what is going on. And so this is what that avidya is, or ignorance. Earlier in the retreat, I talked about greed, hate, and delusion. Okay, so if we think of ignorance, right, as being an underlying darkness, that is the unknown reality in which we live, then greed, hatred, and delusion are manifestations of that ignorance. Greed to want things, hate to want to get rid of things, and delusion. Delusion and ignorance are the same thing, basically, except ignorance is like this primordial darkness, this unknowing, avidya mahatamo khanda, the Buddha described it as. Ignorance, that great mass of darkness. Whereas delusion is that which is hiding the truth. Delusion is an active force that is disguising the true nature of reality from us. Now, when we meditate, we want to know, we want to be aware, and ultimately we want to be free of these things. And the great promise that the Buddha made was that it is possible to be free. Yeah? The Buddha, this is, I think, really important to bear in mind. The Buddha said that he would not teach the Dhamma if it were not possible. It is possible. And he would say this again and again. His whole teaching is premised on that one insight, that it is possible to be free. So despite the fact that ignorance is there, and ignorance goes on for beginningless time, the Buddha said that first beginning of ignorance is not knowable. This is a very profound statement. Actually, in that particular statement, the Buddha is drawing on an even older spiritual tradition and wisdom tradition in Indian philosophy. And I think it's one of the key demarcations between Indian philosophy and Western philosophy. Western philosophy, they always think they know how it started. In the beginning, there was the word. And we know what happened. In the Rig Veda, 1,000 years before the Buddha, Rig Veda is even older than the Bible, or older than the oldest passages in the Bible. It said, it said that even the gods came later than the creation of the earth. So they don't know how this all started. Who knows where this all came from? Who knows what was here before there was nothing? Only he who sits in the highest heaven and gazes down upon all from above, only he knows. Or perhaps even he does not know. So this is a very famous hymn from the Rig Veda, 1,000 years before the Buddha. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine going to a church on a Sunday and singing a hymn? God created all the world, he knows where it's come from, or maybe he doesn't. Right? And it shows that kind of spirit of wonder and openness which was there, you know, and this sort of restless inquiry. And so the Buddha's like, actually, we can't know where this ignorance comes from, how long it lasts. Nonetheless, we can know when it ends, because we can act in such a way, namely by practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, to bring about the ending of ignorance. Now, when we're practicing meditation, each time that we are mindful, each moment of mindfulness is a moment that overcomes ignorance. Each time we see something, that is a moment of truth. And truth and insight does not have to be these big, huge things. Simply hearing something. When you hear something, that is a moment of truth. And so much of our meditation practice is about training ourselves to stick close to what we're actually experiencing and to cut short the tendency of the mind to spin out in different kinds of proliferation. There's a parable, I'm not really sure where it comes from actually, but in Buddhism, where the Buddha and Mara once were hanging out together. It's a bit like the book of Job in that way. Buddha and Mara were hanging out together, and they see a man walking along the path, and this man steps over to pick up a piece of truth from the ground. And when he did that, Mara smiled. And the Buddha says, Mara, why did you smile? He just discovered a piece of the truth. And Mara said, don't worry, give him a minute, he'll make a doctrine out of it. So this is what we're doing. Each time when we meditate, right, you can see that tendency. Something happens, and we start to spin a story about it. We start to wrap it up in words. We start to conceptualize it. We start to expect it, or we start to fear it, or we start to desire it. And we're wrapping that experience up in all of these things, which is all unnecessary, actually. The experience can just remain the experience and then go away. It's impermanent. So through the meditation, we're constantly training ourselves to stick closer to this experience. Now, most of the meditation, most of this retreat, we've been focusing on metta meditation, which falls mostly on the side of the samatha side of the spectrum, tranquility, mostly. And we've been looking a little bit at the insight side of things as well. And I'm going to just discuss these two things for a minute so we can clarify these terms, and then we'll come back to look at how they fit in within that path to awakening. So Samatha, tranquility, samatha is more about like emotional development, right? We're developing metta. Yeah? It's an emotion or compassion. Even if you're developing breath meditation, right? Breath meditation doesn't seem like a particularly emotional thing. It's just a passage of air. Actually, this is one of the things that Ajahn Brahm introduced. Ajahn Brahm was the first person that I ever heard who made us look at the breath through an emotional lens and to see the breath as being something beautiful and something blissful. And he would talk about like holding the breath like you would hold a little baby and just loving the breath like you would love your own child. And that way of talking about breath meditation with that kind of emotional connection and vulnerability, that is what brings the breath meditation alive and stops it from being just a kind of a dry exercise in observation. So other kinds, so these are some of the meditations which are normally classified or normally which emphasize the side of samatha, metta, compassion, mindfulness of breathing. There are many others as well. We've talked a little bit about the kasina meditations where you can focus on like a color or something like that. But the same thing, it's a kasina meditation is not just staring at a color. With the kasina meditation, you have to actually get a feeling of the beauty of that color. Right? This is actually like a word in Pali. It's the subha vimutti is the release from the beautiful, right? The release based on the beautiful. So that aesthetic response draws you into the meditation. Yeah? And so all of these different kinds of meditation have that similar quality that they invite an emotional response. And one of the things which everybody here has learned during this retreat is that, well, those emotional responses are kind of unpredictable. And sometimes it goes as it should, often it doesn't, and all of that stuff, right? So this is all part of your wisdom, right? Actually, understanding this is part on the vipassana side. This is understanding the wisdom. And when I'm listening to the people in the interviews, you know, very often people who are doing the metta meditation, they judge themselves by whether they experience the feeling of metta or not. Yeah? Whereas when I'm listening to them, I'm not really thinking in those kinds of terms. What matters to me is whether somebody has a genuine and sincere engagement with what they're doing. What the nature of that reaction to or response to the meditation is doesn't matter too much, as long as there is a response. That something's happening, something's moving, something means something. This is the thing. Your meditation has to mean something. It's not just fulfilling a bunch of exercises. I've mentioned this kind of a few times, but one of the things that really annoys me in modern meditation discourse is you have this kind of functional or utilitarian language around meditation. You know, I'm going to do these meditation exercises. I'm going to complete this course on meditation. I'm going to use these items in my meditation toolkit and all of this kind of stuff. I hate it. All of that kind of language is reductive, utilitarian language, yeah, where we are cultivating the path to Nibbana. We're not using a toolkit. Yeah. I understand it's just a way of talking, all right? I'm just letting you know that it's a way of talking that just annoys me. That's all I'm saying. Right? So when we're practicing, what does it mean? This is what matters. What does it mean? What kind of person are you? You see, each person who is here on the retreat is different than they were when they started. All of you have been through something. Yeah? Maybe what you've been through is unrelieved pain, agony, and boredom, and you can't wait to go home. But that's at least something. Well, maybe not the best, but yeah. And we can't predict how these journeys will go. Every one of us will have a long, complex journey and so many different pathways and so on that we take. So it's not something that's predictable. Now, what we try to do when we're teaching meditation is to somehow tame it a bit, right? So we're trying to kind of, you know, shepherd you in a certain kind of path so that we have a kind of a sort of coherence in the way that the path is evolving. And that has a number of useful things. One of the things it's useful for is it's helpful for the teacher because it's easier for the teacher to understand what's going on with someone. Yeah. But it also is a way of learning from the wisdom of all of those who've come before us. But on the one hand, you know, we're trying to go that way, but on the other hand, actually everybody is different. So we can't hold that too tightly. So my main concern with doing these kinds of samatha meditations is that we have a genuine emotional engagement with the meditation that we're doing. And through the metta meditation is a great way of doing that. Now, what happens when we do that is that it tends to directly address one of our three little friends, greed, hate, and delusion, namely hate. Yeah? So we're doing metta meditation. We're primarily trying to let go of hate. That's the main focus there. But of course, what you find along the way is that these things are interconnected. Hate and greed are very connected. Right? In fact, a lot of the times you get angry at someone because they don't let you get what you want. Right? That's one of the primordial sources of hate in the world. So we find that when you're developing metta meditation, in theory, overcoming hate, but actually you find it's also helping you to let go of greed and desire as well. Interesting. You become more peaceful, more contented. Yeah? And we're also making the mind more clear, so overcoming delusion at the same time. So this is how this samatha meditation works. Now, if we were to do a different kind of meditation, say we're doing breath meditation or something like that, it would work in a slightly different way, but kind of mostly similar. So mostly the different meditations are going to be fairly similar. In the Theravada tradition, we have a system of, this is not from the suttas, but from the Pali commentarial tradition, there's a system of different characters. And it kind of analyzes all the different meditations and says, like, what character type is good for what particular meditation, all right? So that can be useful. So, for example, if you are a hating type, okay? Should I ask for a survey to see how many people think of themselves as angry types? So if you're an angry type, I should do the survey before and afterwards, actually. See who thinks they're an angry type, and then I'll describe what practice they should have, and then see who thinks they're an angry type. So angry types, okay, if you're an angry personality, you should, the teaching is given in a monastic setting, right? So this is described in a monastic setting. So if you're an angry monk, okay, you should be given the finest hut in the whole monastery. A beautifully decorated place with lovely plastered walls and fine pictures of vines and flowers on the sides. You should be given the loveliest, most delicate robes. You should only be served the most delicious, sweet food served by beautiful people. And you should only get the loveliest things all the time. And that's your path as an angry person. Now who thinks that they're an angry person? Yes, that sounds like the path for me. Yeah. Whereas if you're a greedy person, then you should get the worst hut in the whole monastery. You should be served like the leftover scum from yesterday's rice pot and so on and so forth, all the different things. So there's a whole kind of a way of framing it. Obviously, it's kind of exaggerated and so on. But there's something to it, yeah? And there's something to understanding, like, what your particular personality is. And so this also, the different meditations can be selected. Obviously, if you're an angry person, then metta meditation is recommended. Or, as I mentioned before, like the Subha Vimutti, like the meditation on pure and beautiful colours is also recommended. If you are, what other types are there? If there's, if you're, a, oh, another one, another good one is the speculative type, the one who can't stop thinking all the time. See, the problem with these categories is you look at it and you think, oh, yeah, that sounds like me. Oh, yeah, that sounds like me too. that one's definitely me. And anyway, so another one is one who can't stop thinking, right? And so for that one, then they're recommended to do mindfulness of breathing meditation. So one who's who's a speculative type should have a short walking meditation path, right? So you walk a short time so you can stop, check your mind and turn back again. So there's all these ways that you can learn to sort of work with yourself. Now, of course, the reality is that people's characters are complex and they don't necessarily fit into that kind of scheme exactly, but it still gives you something to learn from. Now, in terms of practicing, generally speaking, mindfulness of breathing is really recommended for all of those characters. It's a universal practice. Yeah? Metta meditation also is fairly universal. Pretty much anybody can do it. Not that everybody has to do it, but it's fine for people to do it. So these are things that are widely recommended. And one of the reasons why they are widely recommended is because they lead to this sense of emotional wholeness. Emotional wholeness. And that is what we're developing through the meditation. Think about it. Think about what it means for your mind to be fractured, to have pulling in different ways, yeah? To be churning or full of tension, like you don't know what you want, or maybe you do know what you want, but you know that you don't want to want what you want. And all of that stuff, right? And all that's all what makes up our mind, right? And all of those tensions and so on. So with samatha practice, we're gradually easing and resolving those tensions until your mind is coherent, nicely, all of that stuff. So that's the process of samatha meditation, and it helps us to overcome particularly greed and hate. Right? These are the two main things that samatha meditation is helping us to overcome. Now, through doing that, this has a number of different effects. One effect is that you feel good. It's nice. You feel nice to be happy and peaceful, and it's better to love than it is to hate. Right? And so because you feel nice and good and peaceful, then you want to keep meditating. And so the more that you can develop those feelings, then the more that's going to draw you in to meditate, and particularly the more that's going to sustain you to meditate for the rest of your life. Because it isn't just about this retreat. Meditation should be something that is part of you for the rest of your life. Yeah? And I think very meaningful to think about that, because then that shapes the kind of person that we're going to become and the kind of person that we think of ourselves. Yeah? Because we're living with meditation in your life, you're living a life of reflection, a life of growth, a life where you are always coming back to yourself, taking responsibility for your feelings, changing, shifting, growing, becoming more aware. And this is the path of spiritual development and spiritual growth. Another huge benefit that samatha meditation has is it creates a place of safety. And this is why it's really important to have a time and a place and a context in which to meditate. Remember the very first meditation we learned? A time, a place, a posture, meditation method, all of these things. Yeah? All of these things are creating a zone of safety for you. That it's and you're training your mind to know, oh, this is a place I can come back to. Ah, I can be with my mind and I can be peaceful and happy and loving and caring with myself and with my mind in this meditation space. And you train yourself in that every day, doing your meditation practice. Sometimes when we meditate, we cry. Sometimes we shake. Sometimes we laugh. Sometimes we fall into depression. Sometimes you're meditating and you have no idea what reality is or how to function or anything else. And many of you on this retreat so far have had all kinds of different experiences in meditation, or not. Doesn't matter. The point is that in that meditation, any of those experiences are okay. And that is a place where you can just feel anything. And you can experience anything. And it's okay. It's okay. Why? Because it has boundaries. Because the meditation has a place. And because it has a time that begins and ends. Because anything that happens there, you can set it aside and leave your meditation. Remember, when we've been doing the metta meditations, every time we do the metta meditations, what do? We put the meditation down. We end the meditation. Give ourselves some space, and then we come out of it. Yeah? A lot of people ask, oh, can I just take that metta from the meditation and then just keep it going outside? Seems reasonable enough, but no. You need to train yourself that everything that's happening in the meditation can be there. Yeah? Because not everything that happens will be something that you're going to want to take outside. You'll be in that meditation, you'll be experiencing, oh my God, everything is impermanent, nothing means everything, everything's empty, nothing is anything, and then you have to get out and go and do the groceries. And I know that Norway is a very progressive, enlightened culture and so on, but if you go to the grocer and say, I'm sorry, I can't pay for this because money means nothing to me. I don't know if that's going to go across all that well. I mean, you could try it. In fact, when I was in my band, we were traveling across Australia. We went to a town called Mildura, and in the middle of the country, and we ended up at this one restaurant in the evening having some dinner. And it turns out this restaurant ran according to karmic credit. That's what they said, pay now or pay later. And so they just gave like suggested prices on the menu, and they said, but pay whatever you want. Yeah, pay now or pay later. So that's pretty good. Yeah. Sorry? I think we asked them about it. Yeah, they're actually really nice people, and we chatted with them and so on. We actually had, because we were touring with our band, we had a good meal, and you know, we paid. In the morning they invited us back and they gave us breakfast for free. So they're really good. But they said that actually most of the time they do just fine. They said there's one group of people who kind of come in and sort of take advantage of it, but that's only one group. They said everybody else is pretty good. Yeah. Where was I? Karmic credit, not paying for things. Oh, that's right. You're having to learn to cope, right? So you're training your mind to create that safe space, which is a container for your meditation. This is why I don't agree with people who say, oh, you don't have to meditate, you can just be mindful in daily life. I don't agree. Obviously, being mindful in daily life is good, sure. But you don't have that space to go so deep and so fearlessly and so utterly into that space of meditation. Yeah? That's what we're training ourselves for. So all of the things I've been talking about so far are on the side of the samatha meditations. Again, it's mostly emphasizing that emotional wholeness and so on. But, of course, we haven't really talked about the delusion, the vipassana side, and that's what we practiced a little bit this morning. But, of course, we've been doing a little bit on that vipassana side all through the retreat as well, because we've been reflecting on the meditation, looking back, and investigating cause and effect. So just to give a kind of a swift definition, vipassana is usually understood as being the investigation of the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, and not self, in all conditioned things. So those all conditioned things are often described as either the six senses, which is probably the easiest gateway to get into vipassana, because it's pretty obvious what those six senses are. Another gateway that people use is the five aggregates or five khandhas, which is probably a bit more difficult to get into because they're a bit more complicated to understand what you're doing. Or another way would be the elements of earth, water, fire, and air, physical elements, material elements, or various other things. So the various ways of like getting like an access to vipassana meditation. But they all focus on seeing impermanent suffering and not self leading to letting go. So I talked a little bit about the theory and practice of vipassana meditation this morning. Now, when we're doing samatha meditation and we're mostly overcoming that greed and hate, when we're doing the vipassana meditation, we're mostly overcoming the delusion. Yeah, this is the main focus of it. And we're overcoming the delusion by seeing a bit of truth, one bit at a time. I'm going to talk a little bit about the realization of truth in Buddhism. So in Buddhist epistemology, we have essentially two ways of seeing the truth, or two ways of knowing. In fact, these two ways of knowing are almost universal in all Indian schools of epistemology. They all argue about what they mean, but the basic idea is the same. First way is through direct experience. The second way is through inference. Okay? Direct experience and inference, two ways of knowing. Okay? So direct experience, when you hear a sound, you're hearing that sound. Now, at that time, that's all you know. Right, you know that sound and you know that clearly, right? So you've got a little bit of truth there. And in our meditation, especially vipassana meditation, we are trying to get as close to that raw truth of experience as we can. Right? That's what we're trying to do. And we're trying to stay there. Now, samatha is helping us to do that because the samatha meditation has given us some stability, some clarity, yeah, which is helping us to focus and to stay with those things longer. But even more importantly, the samatha meditation is giving us a sense of confidence. Right? It's trained us to know that you are powerful, that you are whole, that you can see, that you can know. And it's trained us to know that inside you there is a place of happiness and love and acceptance and joy. And with that confidence, you can step forward to see that things are impermanent. So this is why I think it's really important that there is the Buddha always taught a balance of samatha and vipassana. Always. Almost every time when these things are taught in the suttas, the Buddha was talking about them together and he was talking about the balance of these things. Now, modern day meditation, especially 20th century meditation, that balance, I think, was broken. And a lot of people started teaching just vipassana. And I think that's unfortunate. There are historical reasons for that, but I think it's unfortunate. The balance is so important. So we see that impermanence, we see that suffering, we see that not self. Okay? But we start with seeing the raw experience. Now, the interesting thing about the raw experience, I want you to just stop for a minute and think about what raw experience is like. And say you can listen now to the sounds in the room. So there's a few things about that quality. Like one thing is that you can only hear in the present, right? You can't hear in the past and the future. So if we're hearing that raw experience, we're already in the present. Yeah? So this is one advantage that we have. Another kind of property of that raw experience is that there's kind of an openness to it. Like if I'm listening for what that sound is, I'm kind of receiving what that is and I'm not imposing on the world. Right? It's receptive. Yeah? That's another property of it. Okay. Now, quick question. Can we hear that sound is impermanent? Yeah?
Yes, when it ends.
You can hear that it's impermanent when it ends, okay? But when the sound has ended, it's not there. Sorry?
Or when you leave the room, like you displace yourself from the sound.
You remove yourself from the sound, okay. But the sound, but can you hear that is, like you when it's ended, you hear silence. Or you hear the space where the sound was. But can you hear the sound being impermanent?
In the moment,
not. It's a funny thing, isn't it? Because you listen to the sound and you hear the sound, oh yeah, I can hear that sound changing and so on. But actually, in the present, all you can hear is the sound or not the sound. The idea that the sound is changing is an inference. Because you have to compare this sound, this moment, with the previous one. Yeah, which involves memory, right? And so we have a memory of that experience, which kind of like ties that sound into sort of a kind of web of meaning, and then we kind of see, oh, this has changed compared to what we thought. And of course, that's fallible. We think things have changed when they haven't changed all the time, or the opposite. We don't notice that they've changed when they in fact have changed. So to perceive change is actually an inference. Am I losing you? Are you with me? Yeah. So one of the things that happens when we start to consider this, the epistemology, like the ways of knowing these things, is you begin to realize that the scope of raw data, the scope of what they call pachaka, is direct experience, is in fact a lot narrower than we think. Or another way of saying the same thing is that our mind does a lot more work in processing and interpreting the world than we think. We think that this is just the world as it is. In fact, it's the world that we are processing and creating for ourselves. So if the impermanence of that sound is an inference, what about a more generalized statement, like all conditions are impermanent, right? This is the basic insight of Vipassana meditation. All sounds are impermanent. All conditions are permanent. Of course, that's an even bigger inference because you can't possibly hear all sounds or experience all conditions. You can only experience this one. And you have a memory of other ones that you've experienced. And you draw the inference that all conditions are impermanent. So vipassana involves these two aspects, direct experience and inference. Actually, this is taught in a very nice kind of way in the Mahapadana Sutta, where the Bodhisattva is a kind of story of like the past life of the Bodhisattva, and he's reborn in this very precocious, and he was called in those days Vipassi, was his name, Vipassi, i.e. the one who has vipassana. And they said, why was he called Vipassi? He was called Vipassi because when he was born, he could see things that were very far away. Right? So he could discern things that were a long way away. Yeah? So this is that direct experience. And he was also called Vipassi because when he was just a boy, his dad was the king and his dad would put him on his lap and he would listen to the court cases that were being held. And he would infer the correct judgment for the court case. Yeah? This is also why he's called Vipassi. So this is giving us very clearly these two aspects of clear seeing and inference. And these two aspects are part of how insight works. The reason why I'm emphasizing this is because I think a lot of teachers or some teachers in 20th century Buddhism, again, have kind of lost sight of this and emphasize, insight is all just direct experience only. That's not the case, certainly in the suttas. It's not the case according to reason, and it's not the case according to literally any Buddhist tradition. Inference is an essential part of the development of insight. But the key to insight is that is to understand how that inference works. Now, many of you would know, or perhaps some of you would know, there's a saying in the physics community that they talk about the bed, the bus, and the bath. Do you know that saying? Anyone know that? The bed, the bus, and the bath. These are where all of the great insights come from. Right from the time of, was that Archimedes? Is it Archimedes? Reclining in the bath and then realized, oh, that's how I do it. And his problem was he had to measure, he had to find out there was a statue, he had to figure out what is the volume of the statue so he could figure out whether the gold was adulterated. How do you measure the volume of a statue? He lies down in the bath, sees the bathwater going up, and realizes, oh, that's how you do it. Leaps out of the bath naked, runs down the streets of Athens crying, Eureka, Eureka. Yeah? And the funny thing is that if you look in the history of physics, every single major insight in physics comes in exactly the same way. Well, maybe not quite. Maybe not with baths, but something like that. And all of them, if you look in the biographies and so on, it comes from some moment of intuitive insight. Somehow, yeah? Maybe it's a dream. You know, the chemical structure of benzene appeared in a dream of two coiling snakes. Wakes up and goes, oh, this is what benzene structure is. All of these, they all come the same way, some kind of intuition. Professor Higgs, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the Higgs boson, he made a really interesting comment when he won that prize. He says he doesn't think he'd be able to do it today because they get the professors doing too much work. Too much, you know, he used to spend his days wandering around on the hills, you know, just going for walks. And that's how he found out, you know, discovered the Higgs boson. So this is how inference comes. Inference comes in an intuitive manner. It arises from your experience. And that's what leads to letting go. You see, the problem is not so much that we're attached to this feeling, right? Actually, who cares? You get a feeling, you're attached to it, doesn't matter. That feeling's going to end in a minute anyway. Whatever, it literally doesn't matter. The problem is that you're going to get attached to the next one and the one after that and the one after that, and you're going to keep getting attached to them. That's your problem. So this is why inference is such an important thing. So when we are meditating, yeah, we are seeing that raw data of experience. And the more that we accumulate that raw data, then the more powerful the inference that we can make. And this relates to those stages of the meditation that we went through this morning. The first stage of the meditation was to the jnana parinya, to see what is known. Right? We went through each of the senses. This is the eye, this is the sights, this is the eye consciousness. And we just tried to see those things in and of themselves, the raw data, as much as possible, staying close to it. And then we started to contemplate the impermanence of it, the conditionality of it, the connections between them. And this is moving to that inferential stage. Yeah? And the outcome of that is a letting go. It's interesting that that moment of intuition brings with it a sense of peace. There's a sense of knowing that arises in you when you get the answer to something. Think about it, like even just something that's very basic. If you ask like a mathematical problem, you're like, what's that? Oh, blah, blah, blah. You're trying to work it out. And there's a kind of feeling of tension in you. And then when you get it, that's it. Or even like doing jigsaw puzzles, exactly the same thing. There's a tension because the puzzles are over the place and you don't know how things fit together. And suddenly, this one goes in there. Click, you feel good. People like it. It's this tiny little dopamine hit. Right? And that's why you go the next one and the next one and the next one, yeah? That's how they build jigsaw puzzles. It's also how they built Facebook. That's how they build TikTok. That's how you get an entire generation of teenagers addicted to TikTok. A little bit of dopamine. Now. So that feeling of pleasure that you get from insight leads to a sense of peace. And that sense of peace is going to then support your samatha meditation, just as your samatha meditation is also going to support your insight meditation. And this is one of the things that somebody asked Ajahn Chah about this, about the relationship between samatha and vipassana, and what he said was Ajahn Chah? It might have actually been Ajahn Brahm. Anyway, whatever, who cares? Somebody impressive said that... I think it was Ajahn Brahm, actually. Anyway, whatever. Somebody said that you know when your samatha meditation is going well because it supports your insight. And you know when your insight is going well because it supports your tranquility. Yeah? These things always go together. When they support each other and when they come into unity, then you experience that deep letting go. And that deep letting go brings with it a profound set of peace, a profound sense of peace. In the meditation itself, the metta meditation that we've been doing, I think probably everybody here has experienced some peace through that meditation, whatever kind of level of peace that has been. Of that peace that you experienced, all of it, all of that peace comes because you let go of something. And if you experienced a little bit of peace, it came because you let go of something a little bit. And if you experience a lot of peace, it's because you let go of a lot. And if you experience ultimate peace, it's because you let go of everything. This is how that path works. So samatha and vipassana help us to do this. The general understanding in Buddhism is that the letting go of those things that are causing of suffering happens in three levels. The first level is the level of behavior. Right? And so that one we overcome by taking precepts. The second level is the level of a psychological level, which is what we're overcoming through doing metta meditation, through doing breath meditation, the arising of thoughts or feelings of hate and anger and so on, and to find peace. And then the final level is the underlying level, the level of the anusayas, or underlying tendencies. And that is what is overcome through the practice of insight. And that's what we call the different stages of enlightenment in Buddhism. So at a certain point, when all of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are present, when your mind has been cleared of the five hindrances, when your insight has been developed and your wisdom has been developed, and all of these things are mature and fully developed and fully ripened, then your mind sees the Four Noble Truths. And with that seeing of the Four Noble Truths, you let go of some of the fetters that are binding us to suffering. And that moment is what we call a moment of stream entry. A moment of stream entry is the first of the Buddha stages of enlightenment, and it marks an irreversible break from being bound onto the wheel of samsara and the wheel of suffering. So that goal of stream entry is not something that you can determine. It's not something that you can fix. It's not something you can program. It is something that arises as a spontaneous, intuitive inference wisdom that comes when all of those conditions are ready and are ripe. The Buddha described that experience as being like a flash of lightning in the darkness of night. And when that happens, you realize how profound the scope of ignorance really is. How much reality is masked from us, and how powerful the Dhamma is that it can unmask that ignorance. And so that's that moment of stream entering. All of you, I believe, have the capacity to realize all of these things. I'm not sitting here teaching because I've got nothing better to do with my life. I'm not sitting here teaching because he told me to. And I'm not sitting here teaching because of real. I'm certainly not sitting here teaching to make money. And I'm only teaching this for one reason, and that is because I have faith in the Dhamma, and I have faith that each one of you can practice the Dhamma. And I've seen in the interviews, I've seen every person coming along who I've spoken to in ways small and large, practicing, realizing, developing, and engaging with the Dhamma in a sincere way. And I never have any doubt that you can realize these things, that we can all realize these things. So if you want to, if you want to give up, if you want to tell yourself that you can't do it, okay, you can do that. But somewhere in the back of your mind, you know that you have let go. And in that letting go, you have found peace. And nobody can ever take that away from you. The path to Nibbana is nothing more than that path. If you can let go a little bit, surely you can let go a bit more. That's how these things go. So when we're practicing, don't worry too much about how it's going, what meditation you're doing, all of these kinds of, all of these are incidental. The main thing is to keep that sense of sincerity and that sense of meaning in your heart, that you know that you're dedicated to that path of awakening, and that little by little and step by step, we're moving from darkness towards the light, from ignorance towards knowledge, from suffering towards freedom. So this is my little talk for you this evening on Samatha and Vipassana, about the nature of the defilements and so on, and about the path to freedom.